Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us here in Studio A, Congressman John Shimkus. We're going to get a Washington update. My goodness, there's an awful lot going on in Washington right now. When it rains, it pours. And it's pouring. We'll talk about some of those issues here for the next 25 minutes of the program. Then at 4:30, Dr. Martin Noland also joins us here in Studio A. John's keeping his seat warm for him right now. We'll talk about Luther's wife, Katie Luther. I don't know if it's true or not, but Luther is said to have referred to Katie as his rib. And I do know there is one quote where he says, you know, before I met Katie and before I was married, I would work all day and all night. I would come home drenched in sweat. I would lay in dirty sheets and sleep through the night, toss and turn. And then I married Katie, and Katie kept house. She did. She ran Luther's financial affairs in his house throughout their long marriage. We'll talk about this remarkable woman coming up in about 25 minutes. And then Pastor Walt Snyder joins us. We'll talk about the O Antiphons of Advent, these ancient songs sung during this season by the church. Congressman John Shimkus is a regular guest here on the program, and he is from the 19th District of Illinois. John, it's always a pleasure to have you. Welcome back. It's good to see you face to face.
Yeah, it's good to be in studio with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, the thing that is causing all of the flap now, and has for the better part of the weekend and this week, is the eavesdropping scandal that is swirling around President George W. Bush. Your general thoughts on what this is really about and what transpired?
Well, you have to figure out the whole story, and that's first thing you hear about, you go, oh, he shouldn't do that. And then you find out it deals with the Federal Intelligence Securities Act, or the Foreign Intelligence, the FISA it's called. And then you sit here that it's overseas calls, not United States continental local calls. Then you find out it stems from one case that you grab a terrorist in Pakistan. You know he's a terrorist. He has a cell phone on him. You look at the cell phone, you see the numbers, and you see U.S. numbers on there. What do? Do you wait for the week it takes to just file an appeal to this court, and then however long it takes the court to say, yeah, you can eavesdrop it on it, or do you do it? And I think what will because the news will break that you got this guy.
Sure.
And once the news breaks, people are going to ditch those numbers. I mean, they're not going to use those numbers. So I would expect that this opens up this debate on this. And then during this debate, we'll find out how the president can do it immediately while keeping within the intent of the law, which is eventually have some oversight.
Do you expect that there will be – some have called for an investigation and congressional hearings. Do you expect that this is going to happen?
I think the calls will continue, and I would expect the more research done, and whether the hearings occur, I'm not sure.
The president made a case in his speech, and then in the press conference after the speech yesterday, that look, in order to do this, it's got to be secret as anything can possibly be. Otherwise, it doesn't work at all. And to talk about it, I think he even said in his press conference yesterday, the very fact that we're talking about this is in some small way telegraphing to our enemies what we're doing. Have we lost, in your opinion, an advantage here that may have been gained through this effort for the last 4 years now that this information has leaked?
Well, I think most people understand that if we have the ability to listen or eavesdrop or read emails and we know that they're bad guys, we're going to try to do that. The real question is when the president finds the timeliness of when the president finds out. I think most of us legislators, people in the public policy arena, want to make sure that there is some review of decision-making by the chief executive. So I would side with let him do it. Go for it. Don't let the window of opportunity close. But while you're doing that, go through at least the House Select Committee on Intelligence or the court system and keep doing it until they say no.
So at the very least, allow Congress this kind of oversight that it already exercises over some of this stuff, and at least inform the principal actors.
I think it'd keep them out of trouble. I think that would be a healthy thing to do.
All right. Turning from that to the other big news that's almost been tossed off the headlines because of the eavesdropping thing is the Iraqi elections. You've been in Iraq several times. I think that the vice president was just recently in Iraq as well. What do this second round of elections mean for the Iraqi people?
Actually, a third round, really.
Yes, third.
I think it confirms that there is a plan, and this was the third part of the electoral plan, to go from a transitional National Assembly to have a referendum on a constitution, and now to elect the first full-time government, and they have to go through that process. The Iraqis politically have met every timeline that we've laid out. And they are, so that part of the plan is being executed, and I think trying to get more security and an operational military will help provide security. And as they ramp up, our presence will be decreased. And I fully expect by this time next year to have less U.S. presence in Iraq than we do today.
What's it like in Iraq? I mean, when was the last time you were there, and what did you see when you were there?
Well, I'm actually in the planning stages of going back because it's been a year since I've been there. A lot has changed in a year. The first time I was there was a couple months after the war. It was fairly safe. We drove around the streets in a convoy and stuff. Second time, security was tighter. We moved by helicopter. But people who are returning now are seeing more freedom, more activity on the streets. And if you talk to soldiers, men and women who have returned, they're all, 99.9% of them are very, very positive. And if you listen to my colleagues in a bipartisan, either Democrats or Republicans, who come back, they're also very, very positive of the changes in Iraq. Americans are very impatient. And we forget that we've had soldiers deployed in Western Germany and Japan and on the Korean Peninsula for over 50 years. In peaceful, democratic environments and institutions. It's a little bit tougher when the environment is not as safe, but immediate withdrawal from Iraq would be foolhardy. It'd be a terrible mistake, and it would send a terrible signal that we're not serious about democracy and freedom.
Well, one of your colleagues in the House, I believe, former Marine, called for, it was debated afterwards, an immediate withdrawal or a stage of withdrawals from Iraq, and that was the big talk. Is that still seriously being called for by people in Washington?
Not after we called his bluff on that vote, and it was overwhelmingly in opposition to Murtha's position, and then following up that, we debated that again this week with just the premise of, are we there to win? Are we there to help? We want to commend the Iraqis. We want to support their move to democratization. And we're there to defeat the insurgents and the terrorists. And again, overwhelming support of members of Congress. So what they say politically versus what they really do, sometimes I know it's hard to believe in Washington, it's two different things.
Two other questions on Iraq. One has to do with the infrastructure. And the other one has to do with the training of an Iraqi police force or security force. I heard one of the military officers interviewed a couple of weeks ago who's in charge of the training of the Iraqi force. And he says, look, this is not a matter of teaching people how to point a gun and pull the trigger. Most of these people know how to do this. Some of these people were conscripted against their will into Saddam Hussein's army. They know how to do this stuff. The question is organizing them into a force that can actually deal with the insurgency over there. Does that sound like the real challenge that they're facing there?
The General Petraeus, and I'm not sure if he is the one who's been involved with training the Iraqi forces. Not only that, how can they be engaged? I mean, we've got the best military in the world. We have junior leadership, NCOs, non-commissioned officers, corporals and sergeants, E5, E6s, staff sergeants, sergeant first classes. They run independently. You're taking an old Iraqi military that was officer-controlled, mass, kind of the old Soviet style, and you're trying to develop leaders. that will work independently. And that's a challenge. Also, you're trying to make sure that they are not just military groupings of ethnicity based upon, well, we have a Shia unit here, we have a Sunni unit here, we have a Kurd unit here. You're trying to make sure that they are an Iraqi military that's not tied to their ethnic background. Those are all great challenges. I think they are coming under some success.
We're talking with Congressman John Shimkus live here in Studio A. We'll take your phone calls on Things Political, our Washington update. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin, and you're listening to Issues Etc. The other one had to do with the infrastructure. My brother was over there for about a year, a reservist, a captain in the Army, and with an engineering unit that got moved all around, but mostly stayed at the western tip of the Sunni Triangle in Ramadi. A dangerous place to be.
Very dangerous.
And he said, look, I saw their power plants, I saw their water treatment plants, I saw everything. Everything they had was top of the line for 1985. But it hadn't been taken care of in 25 years. It had been let to just fall apart. And he said, at least he told me, the amount of work to bring this thing up to a functioning society is unbelievable.
And the problem is that they have the oil reserves to help pay for that, those changes, but the insurgency disrupts the ability to pay. It disrupts the work on repairing these areas. The story I tell, it's even worse than that. I went to Al Dura, the power plant. They generate electricity by burning crude oil, high sulfur crude oil. More smoke's going out the sides of the stack than out of the top of the stack. Built in 1965, the newest piece of equipment was a generator that was had a date stamp of 1972 on it. And the power lines weren't upgraded, and that is the challenge, is a infrastructure that was left to decay.
Turning domestically, what's the current state of the U.S. economy, in your opinion?
Well, it's, by anybody's objective look, it's actually going pretty good. GDP, 3.5%. 4.4 million jobs in the past 4 years. Just try to get a parking spot at one of these malls at Christmas. You can't get in it. So we have challenges. We always have challenges. No one's ever wants to be totally happy. But I think the fact that we are having our more income generated to the federal government, that's through taxation because more people are earning dollars, means that the economy is growing.
Gas prices have, depending on what day you buy in gas, doubled in the last year. Is there ever going to be a time when we go back to $1.50, $1.60, maybe even $1.75 gas?
Oh, I hope so, but I don't know. It's supply and demand related. We have a reliance on foreign imported crude oil. We need to look at alternatives in the renewable fuel area. That's why I drive the E85 Ford Explorer, 85% ethanol, and it's usually 10 to 15 cents cheaper a gallon. I'm also working on old technology, which now with crude oil prices being so high, coal to liquid, where you take coal and turn it into a liquid fuel. It's doable. The Germans did it in World War II. South African company actually produces their liquid fuel that way, and with that would help decrease our reliance on foreign oil. So when you have high prices, people start looking at ways to get into that business. And hopefully that'll diversify our energy. And as people move to more ethanol or more coal to liquid, then that would decrease the reliance on crude oil, which hopefully would bring prices down a little bit.
The House holds the purse strings. I was just teaching my daughter this in her civics class, that all appropriations bill begins with the House. What are your thoughts as a member of the House on the spending that's taking place? George W. Bush, I think it's fair to say, has spent an awful lot as a president. Some he's had to, and some he's just spent. What are your thoughts on that?
We're getting better. I think we've heard the message from our base that we could be better stewards of the spending issue. You know, you're right. This president has raised spending for education through No Child Left Behind. He's raised in the ag bill, we raised more spending. We have the highway bill, more spending. So we stand accused, of course, with September 11th and the buildup of Homeland Security, there's more spending. In this last spending cycle, on the federal spending discretionary, which is the money we can control, remember, a lot of it's entitlement spending. We don't have any control over. We don't have control of Social Security. We don't have control of Medicare. We don't have control of Medicaid. That's two-thirds of our budget right there. So of the one-third that we can control, we did a much better job in actually less dollars spent this year on all the spending items except for defense and Homeland Security. So that was part of the fight. That's part of the reason why we stayed in Washington so long. People wanted us to spend more money. We ended up spending less. And even in the budget reconciliation bill, $40 billion worth of savings, part of that was pushed because then we have Katrina, we have Rita, and we have to, instead of just going into more debt, we decided to pay for that emergency response to that area.
We had a caller who called, wasn't able to stay on the line, but wanted to know your thoughts on the illegal immigration bill in the House.
Yeah, I've got making some calls on that today. I was supportive of it, and I approach it from the compassionate argument here. It's not compassionate to allow these coyotes to bring smuggle illegal immigrants in and leave them in the desert to die. It's not compassionate to have women, Hispanics, who are abused sexually by the same individuals. It's not compassionate for us to have illegal immigrants who go to some working environment in which, because they're illegal, they're abused. They're paid little. It's the old city towns and stuff. So, but there is a need for immigrant labor in this country. So the best way to be compassionate is to know who's coming across the border. Don't encourage illegality. Allow a process to identify who comes in so that once they come in and they're going to take access to the welfare state and the social services that we have, that they're paying into the system. The first step is to control the borders.
Is it a national security issue?
It's a huge national security issue from Islamic terrorists who pose as Hispanics coming across the border. It's also a national security debate because where does the largest amount of drugs come into our country from? The southern border. Not to be able to control our southern border is something that the public has been crying for ever since I became elected to office, and it's only taken 9 years later that we finally stepped up to the plate. In this bill, we've authorized the building of a fence.
Is this a bipartisan issue, the immigration issue?
It sure is, and it's going to develop and morph as we change with the Senate and look at other provisions. But we wanted to start out on the House side on a real strong border security initiative so that we set the marker for identifying and controlling that border and making sure we know who's coming or who's going.
A couple of quick final questions here. Of local concern, Walgreens, in fact, a couple weeks ago, we talked with one of the pharmacists who had been kind of summarily let go from Walgreens because they refused to sign a Walgreens internal document in which they pledged to fill prescriptions for the morning after pill. And we talked to him on the air a couple weeks ago. What do you know about this issue, and what are your concerns here?
Well, I applaud that individual, making a tough moral choice because I've actually made a call into Walgreens to express my disappointment in their corporate decision. Their response is, you've got a governor in your state, the state of Illinois, who has this law, and we're breaking the law if we allow this pharmacist to continue to work. So I'm trying to use the bully pulpit that I have available to let the corporate heads at Walgreens know that they ought to make sure that they treat their employee in an honorable and just way, especially making a moral and ethical decision, which he has, which I support.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. A quick call as our time winds down with Congressman John Shimkus. Fred calls from Edwardsville. Hi, Fred.
Good day. I would like to talk with the representative regarding and suggesting that there be an improvement made in this Medicare D program. I've been working since November the 15th with a I won't call her disabled, but an incapable senior. There is no one that resides in her residence, and he would know the residence, that is capable of making these decisions without assistance. The Medicare program on the computer is okay, but the confusion factor is that every program they could sign up for is different. Medicare supplements, they get choices of A, B, C, D, and whatever there are, and each one is defined by the government so that no matter where you go, you get the same benefits.
Fred, thank you for the call. Our time is short here. Your thoughts on Medicare D?
I'm very excited about it. I'm going to be in Edwardsville tomorrow with this senior health insurance plan. I want seniors to take the list of what they need and get the plan that best suits them. It's a competitive marketplace. There's 48 choices. And under the current system, there is no choice. There is no help for prescription drug benefits. Now seniors can access some help if they decide to. If they don't, they don't have to.
What about Fred's concerns here that for the person that he's caring for? Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is causing folks of my age working and talking to their parents or even grandparents if they're still around, and that's a healthy thing. In my congressional district, there's been over 20 meetings already to help people talk through the plan. There is, Seniors Health Insurance Program, the SHIP program, that does a great job. This is a debate about having market access and multiple choices. Sometimes multiple choices scare people, but if you want to design a program that best fits you, then we have one in the Medicare D. A one-size-fits-all, it fits very few people that way.
Two final questions here, Congressman Shimkus. Prospects for pro-life legislation in 2006?
Election year, pro-life president. I imagine we'll see some movement on some pro-life legislation, especially we're also watching the court cases on the parental notification that's going on. I would think it'd be a good time to address some of the ones that we always take up, which is cross-state transportation of minors. And would we like to have the big piece of legislation? I don't think so in this cycle.
That brings us finally to the election of 2006. Just in the last 2 days, I've been calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush eavesdropping issue. The House, of course, has to originate articles of impeachment. That's not likely to happen now. But 2006 is going to be very important for the last 2 years of President George W. Bush's term. What do you expect from the elections there? What would be the issues, top three issues, if you could think of three?
Well, I think it's going to be the war is going to be an issue. The economy is going to be an issue. It's all security, economic security, international terrorism security, and probably retirement security.
Congressman John Shimkus, thank you very much for being our guest here in Studio A. Congressman John Shimkus is from the 19th Congressional District of Illinois. Thank you.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, when we come back, we're going to be talking about Katie Luther, Luther's wife. Dr. Martin Noland will join us here in Studio A, director of the Concordia Historical Institute. And then in the last half hour of the program, Pastor Walt Snyder joins us. The church has been singing these hymns, the O Antiphons, for millennia. We will talk about them in the last half hour. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Justification in the Scriptures, old and new challenges to the doctrine by which the church stands or falls, and the Holy Spirit as giver, gift, and gifts are the themes for the annual symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. This year's symposia begins January 17th and ends January 20th. Now for a complete list of speakers, symposia schedule, or to register online, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call area code 260 452-2247. The fellowship alone is worth the registration fee, and you can experience the Christ-centered, cross-focused worship life at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. It's the 2006 Symposia Series, January the 17th through the 20th at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. For more information, issuesetc.org or call area code 260-452-2247.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. Pro-life supporters and those suffering from diseases such as sickle cell anemia, leukemia, and heart disease have been given an early Christmas present. Both houses of Congress passed legislation clearing the way for a national cord blood stem cell bank. The bill is expected to save literally thousands of lives. Bill Wilson reports.
Arizona Congressman Trent Franks worked behind the scenes to help end the political logjam that held up the cord blood stem cell legislation.
I'm thankful that the cord blood cell bill was passed, that we will be able to have a clear alternative to embryonic stem cells.
Wendy Wright of Concerned Women for America says this is one time where practicality won out over politics.
We are grateful for the persistence of congressmen who stood up to the bullies who tried to hold hostage real cures and treatments for patients in order to push their unethical political agenda.
Dr. David Stevens of the Christian Medical Association says cord blood stem cells provide authentic life-saving therapies right now.
There's over 15,000 stem cell transplants every year where this umbilical cord stem cell bank is going to make a tremendous difference. A Korean woman had a transplant of these cells who was completely paralyzed and within 6 weeks was able to get up and walk. We're also seeing them being used in sickle cell disease.
Frank says the bill now goes to the president.
If there's anything Christmas tells us, it's that one child can make a fathomless difference in humanity, and so I think it would be so appropriate if the president does sign it before Christmas.
The president is reportedly eager to sign the bill into law. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bill Wilson in Washington.
The Stem Cell Therapeutic and Research Act of 2005 passed the House in May, but has been stalled in the Senate for months. For Family News in Focus, I'm...
Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has dawned upon you. Nations will stream to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawning. Concordia Publishing House and Holy Cross Lutheran Church invite you to join them this season as Christ illuminates the city. Concordia Publishing House will celebrate the light of Christ on Friday, December 23rd at 1 p.m., and Holy Cross will celebrate his light at 11 p.m. Christmas Eve. Both services are at Holy Cross Lutheran Church, 2650 Miami Street, one block west of the Concordia Publishing House. Come and worship as Christ illuminates the city. Popular author Dandy Daly McCall has written our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, titled The Shepherd's Christmas Story. It's a Christmas book for young children. The Shepherd's Christmas Story is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Or find out more about The Shepherd's Christmas Story on our website, issuesetc.org. The Shepherd's Christmas Story.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Looking forward to this conversation with Dr. Martin Noland on Katie Luther. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for December is a Christmas book, and it's a kid's book, beautifully illustrated, called The Shepherd's Christmas Story. We only have 5 days until Christmas, you know, but you can get this book, $12.99 plus shipping and handling, one of two ways. You can either visit one of the two locations where Concordia Publishing House operates a bookstore here in St. Louis, one at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. Walk in and just say, The Shepherd's Christmas Story, The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for December. They'll know what you're talking about. The other is here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Same thing applies there. Follow the signs to the bookstore. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. And if you want it before Christmas, you will have to ask for express shipping. 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about the book at our website, issuesetc.org. There on our homepage, you'll find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, The Shepherd's Christmas Story. Dr. Martin Noland is a regular guest. He is joining us here in Studio A for the next half hour. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute. Our subject is Katie Luther. We talk an awful lot about Luther. We'll talk about Luther's wife, the mother of his children, for the next 25 minutes. And feel free to join us with any question or comment you may have, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Marty, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Great to be here.
Well, I guess the first question I have is, why are people fascinated with Katie Luther? You don't hear a lot about the John Calvin's wife. I don't even know if he was married, to tell you the truth.
Yes, she was.
You don't hear a lot about Ulrich Zwingli's life. I assume he married at
yeah,
some point.
Yeah, he married too.
Why Katie Luther as the subject of such, really, relatively speaking, very intense interest?
Well, she has an interesting story. She was a former nun, and I'm not sure that Calvin's or Zwingli's wives were. See, Martin Luther was a former monk, and Katharina was a former nun, and so there is some sort of mystery about that. I mean, anybody that's not, including myself, I've never lived in a monastery. You know, what are those monks and nuns doing all day? That is kind of what goes through your mind. So in one sense, they had a unique marriage. Luther was also, you really can't get away from the fact that he was the one that demolished the whole monastic system. And not only on the one hand does he demolish the theological underpinnings of monasticism and tells the princes to close them down, he himself sets up, as it were, a model Protestant family and the first, maybe not the first Protestant parsonage, but certainly a model Protestant parsonage. And so I think that kind of is the reason that there's more interest in this. And the other thing is, this was famous in Luther's day because Luther and Catherine put on a show, as it were, almost. The Luther house where they lived, what used to be the monastery, became the Luther house. They kind of served as a what the Germans call a Gasthaus. It's an inn that serves food and a dinner. And Luther was there holding, when he was in town, he was holding forth at dinner with many different guests. And so the word about the Luther house and his wife and her excellent abilities and talents spread all around the Protestant world because so many people visited there. And you can't say that about the case of Zwingli or Calvin or anybody else.
Let's talk about Catherine's early life. I mean, if we could, in kind of a cursory fashion, where she came from. Is it true that she was of some minor nobility?
Her father was a member of the German Knights, and in that period of time, the Knights were declining in prestige and influence, but he was of some sort of what they call lesser nobility. He was a gentleman farmer, which he probably meant he didn't get his hands dirty too much. He had peasants do the work. He had a small feudal estate. Interesting that the von Boras were also probably of a mixed German and Wendish descent. So that's their ancestry. So yes, there was some aspect of nobility, but not high nobility. That means that her father was of the knight class, which was declining in prestige.
So this would have been landed gentry, people owning land.
Yes, and not a lot of land. And I couldn't tell you how many acres, but it wouldn't be a lot. It would be enough to that with a couple of servants, he could support himself and maybe go off. You know, he would have to serve in war whenever his prince would send him to war. But there wasn't a lot of money left over. He wasn't living in a palatial castle.
How does she end up in the convent?
This is the first part of Katharina's development as a person, and I think very, very crucial. Her mother died when she was five. Her mother's name was Anna, and then the father pretty much immediately remarried. And at that point, they decided to take Katharina out of the house. So they sent her away to a convent school, which meant that she was going to like a grammar school taught by nuns. And then when she got to be 10 years old, instead of coming back to the house, her father, without consulting with her or ascertaining her will, put her into a monastery, a nunnery, and that was to be for the rest of her life. So basically, he got rid of Katharina. And later on, when Katharina escaped from the convent, before she was considering getting married to Martin Luther, Luther tried to contact her father, and he did not want her back. So at the beginning of her life, Katerina has this devastating experience of losing her mother and then being rejected by her father and not ever being wanted back. That's critical to understanding her.
Is this unusual, what her father did by sending her away?
Not all that unusual. Perhaps the combination of mother dying, and even that often happened. This is part of the purpose, from a social standpoint, of the monasteries and nunneries, is that the nobility would have lots of children, and then they would decide which of their heirs would take over their property or their particular affairs of state, and the rest of them they would send off to the monasteries and nunneries so that they couldn't cause any revolts or any disturbances. And I guess the only difference here is Katerina, this happened to her at a very early age, and so basically she grew up as an orphan, and we have to understand that about her. The nunnery was her home. The sisters were her family, and she had a very early sense of rejection from her parents. Well, the loss of her mother and the rejection of the father.
And how does it come about? You've said several times here that she escapes from the monastery where she served as a Cistercian. How does this thing come about, and how does it coincide with her first contact with Luther?
The escape from the nunnery occurs, it's initiated by Luther's own writings. In a previous show, we talked about Luther's top five writings. One of those was his judgment on monastic vows, written in 1521. Somehow this writing and some of his other treatises ended up in that monastery, and it was being distributed throughout Germany at the time. And some of the nuns read this material and said, "This, we agree with this." And so 12 of the nuns penned a letter to Martin Luther in Wittenberg asking him if he could arrange somehow, they didn't know how, for their release from the nunnery and back into normal life. And, well, this was difficult to do, and it is the only time he ever did this. But he did know a merchant that regularly went into the nunnery to sell a variety of food items. His name was Leonard, I believe, Coppe. And anyway, this merchant made arrangements with the 12 nuns, and during the Easter vigil, which would be late at night, Easter Saturday, the Saturday before Easter, after everybody had finished a full day of preparations for Easter, most of the sisters fell asleep, and the 12 remained asleep and escaped over the gate into Coppe's wagon and went to Torgau, which was nearby, and then eventually to Wittenberg. And so Luther himself was responsible for these 12 nuns escaping, and that was a crime. It was punishable by death. So Luther had not only committed a crime, at least in that part of Saxony, and also he became responsible for these 12 nuns personally.
We're talking about Katie Luther. Dr. Martin Noland is our guest. Today is the 20th day of December. That's the day that the church remembers Katie Luther. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Joe, who calls from his car. Joe, thanks for waiting and welcome.
Hi. My question may call for some speculation, but I'll ask anyway. Do you know what Katie Luther would think or would have thought of the feminism that is becoming prevalent in our church today, or in society in general? And two, assuming she would have taken a conservative approach to that, have there been instances of people trying to do a little historical revision and spin her life to say that she would have supported feminist issues?
It's a very interesting question. Two parts there. What would she have made of the feminist impulse that's made its way very strongly into some streams of Luther's descendants?
Well, what I know about Katerina, and we don't know a lot. It wasn't as if she had written treatises on theology. We do have some letters of her, very few. Most of what we have is what other people report about her. She was a very pious lady, and after getting to know Luther and the Reformation, she took her cue from what the scripture said. So I think that she would be puzzled by, as probably Luther would himself be, by the modern feminists. And their desire to be, well, free of all restrictions in some cases, perhaps equal to their husbands in all respects, or whatever they're asking for. I think that would be somewhat puzzling. On the other hand, we have to say that in some sense, both Luther and Katie were liberators. I mean, they were working against the established order, but it was different from the modern sense in which people make up their own ideas about what a certain human right is, and then they follow that. That would really be far from their way of thinking. What they were basing their liberation on was the original order for the Christian church as found in scriptures. And so from that standpoint, they would not understand the feminist issues of today.
And very briefly, to your knowledge, have anyone tried to spin Katie's story into a feminist story?
Yes. And actually, when my wife and I were in Germany, we were in, I believe it was in Eisenach at a museum there, and it was talking about the role of women in the church, and they kind of portrayed Katie as, of course I'm reading this in German over there, but they kind of portrayed Katie as a liberator, and then the final result today are the female preachers in the German state church. So that, yes, there are people that have done that, but I just don't think it's responsible with what we know about her or about any of the historical material.
You mentioned that Luther became responsible, legally responsible, for the 12 that he liberated, smuggled out of this Cistercian monastery or nunnery. How does he initially tries to marry the ladies off? That's a good way of being responsible for them. And even Katrina. Why does Luther resist marriage himself? And why does he eventually change his mind? And since she's the last one that he's responsible for, take Katie as his wife.
Luther wanted to remain single because he was under the ban. He expected death any time. You know, a band of the imperial army could show up at the door of Wittenberg by night, and Luther would have been apprehended and off with his head, and that's it. Certainly not a great way to raise a family. And he was very conscientious about that issue. You see it throughout his writings after the Diet of Worms. Also, I think there's a sense that he has a sense of single-minded devotion to the church, which goes hand-in-hand with the way he used to think as a monk, where he was single-mindedly devoted to the monastic life. Now, he changed his mind for several reasons. First off, he was at this time, about, this is 1523, 1524, 1525, he's encouraging the Archbishop Albrecht of Mainz to marry. Now, that would be an enormous accomplishment for the Reformation, because the Archbishop is one of the main leaders of the church, almost equal in status in some ways to the Pope. And so in order to do that, he had to use a lot of arguments and think through himself, why is it good for a pastor to get married? Well, of course, if he's going to say these things, it's going to come back to haunt him, which it does. And then his friends, this whole nunnery escape incident, he marries off a lot of these young ladies to his friends. And then they come back to him and say, well, what about you, Luther? It would be good for the Reformation if you were married, too. I think what a very influential thing that the historians say was he had taken a trip to visit his father in his old age, his father's old age. His father was close to his deathbed, and he greatly urged Martin to get married and to produce heirs. And finally, is in the case of Katharina, she was the last one left. He had taken care of the responsibilities for all the other nuns. She was still hanging around in Wittenberg, and her issue wasn't settled. And if he married her, that would take care of it.
Is it true that one of Luther's closest friends came to their house on their wedding night and basically interrupted Katie and Luther on their first night as husband and wife?
Well, not exactly, but that's very close. You have to understand how they did weddings in those days. They were betrothed. That is, they went through the promises, what we call the vows of marriage. Katie and Luther did that, let's see, what's the date? On June 13th, 1525. And this was done in their home with the presence of a witness, and I think the mayor of the town, who was Lucas Cranach, and a pastor. And then that night, they were husband and wife, and they were consummated. 2 weeks later, the public wedding ceremony took place, June 27th, at St. Mary's Church at the Portal. That's the picture that's often seen of the two, holding hands, and then they repeat their vows in front of the whole public. After that, they went back to the monastery, which would become their home, and had a great banquet. And toward the end of the banquet is when Luther's old friend Karlstadt showed up. Karlstadt was an Anabaptist who was being hunted by the princes because he was partly responsible for some revolutions. So it's basically at the end of their wedding reception, Karlstadt shows up, and they're kind to him, and they give him a night and actually a couple of weeks to stay before he moved on to his next place.
Well, this kind of begins a trend in their home. You mentioned early in our conversation that Katie, while Luther is busy with the Reformation and the duties thereof, she runs essentially a bed and breakfast from the Luther house. I've been to the house. It's a big place because it is a former monastery. So it's a big kind of courtyard type of an arrangement. Luther's inn, if you will, at least for that day. Tell us a little bit about their arrangement in their home.
This building is what was the Augustinian monastery, and that's what it was when Luther moved there. There was anywhere from a dozen to two dozen monks there up until the time of the Reformation, at which point they left, leaving Luther there all by himself. The building was used for lectures for the university, but it had a lot of rooms, as you said. It's got three main levels plus a dormitory area under the roof plus a basement. And today it's a museum. They call it the Lutherhalle. Well, after Luther got married, there was the issue of, well, where is he going to live with his wife? And so this was given as a gift by the elector, who was Luther's friend, really, to the Luthers. And then she ended up turning this into what the Germans today call a Gasthaus, or we call a bed and breakfast. And so part of it is the life around the dinner meal that occurs. And so, you know, if you go to a Gasthaus in Germany, what you usually do is you'll have the dinner there, you'll stay overnight in the morning, breakfast is part of the deal too. And this became like a miniature inn, and she was in charge. And she was, because of her work that she had done in the nunnery, she had a lot of different responsibilities. She had a lot of skills. She was a very good worker, and this just worked out for her. She was very good at it. And this, you could call it like the White Horse Inn was something that happened at Cambridge, and there's a radio station in California that's named after that. The White Horse Inn, I think, was modeled after, I don't mean the radio station, but the Cambridge thing was modeled after what was going on in Wittenberg. And it was a gathering place. Every day, at least when Luther was in town, the people could meet with Luther, and there was a regular sign-up sheet. If you were a guest in the house, you were always welcome at the table, but then you had to pay. Students would often stay there for a length of time, sometimes for their entire academic career. Guests from out of town, princes, personal friends of the Luthers, and then she would provide the food, and he would kind of lead the conversation, kind of like the chairman in a meeting.
Is this where we get the table
right,
talks?
Right, it's exactly where we get the table talks. And furthermore, that's where we know about Katerina, because she would come in and she'd, you know, serve one of the entrees, and then she'd stand or sit around, and she'd have her own ideas about things. And she was actually a very good lay theologian. And that's where a lot of people knew and grew to appreciate Katerina, and that gave her her celebrity even in her days.
If you would, in the last few minutes here, talk about two things: their family, that is the children that they had, and the family life in the Luther house, and then if you would transition to Luther's death and Katerina's life after Luther's death.
The Luthers had six children, and two of them died young. One of them died at 6 months. The other died at 13, which was, that was a great loss. Always, any child is a loss, of course. The oldest child was Johannes. He was a lawyer and became a government official. The second son was Martin, who was a pastor, but he was not in good health, and so he really did not serve a parish. There was a third son named Paul, who was a physician and served in various courts as a personal physician to princes. And then finally Margaret, who married a nobleman, Georg von Konheim, who was around Königsberg, and she had about 9 children. That was the most of the grandchildren. And then you asked
her
about,
what was Katie's life after Luther's death?
Well, she had troubles because under Saxon law, the widow could not own property, and her sons were not old enough to be her guardians. This was partly because the Luthers married late. So the state put her under guardianship, and that was administered by the chancellor of the court, who was named Gregory Brooke. And Brooke did not like Katerina. We don't know all the reasons. He was one of those that authored part of the Augsburg Confession. But he did not like her, and he wanted to take everything away from her that she owned. So she had a fight for her rights, the Luther house, and estates. And she got some help with Melanchthon and a few friends, but she found that after Luther died, a lot of their friends kind of walked away, which was very, very disappointing for her. And Melanchthon himself, during his funeral address for her, mentions how so many people in Wittenberg abandoned the Luthers after Martin's death.
She died in an wagoning accident, actually, in 1522. As a final question, with no more than a minute, what is Katie Luther's greatest contribution to the church?
Katie's greatest contribution is the fact that she was a support to her husband, Martin, and that she was a good example of piety and diligence for all people, whether male or female. And she carried out a lay vocation. She was not a pastor, but she did it with diligence and with humility, and she greatly served the Reformation in many ways by assisting her husband, Martin Luther.
Dr. Martin Nolan is director of the Concordia Historical Institute based in St. Louis. Marty, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, yes, I said 1522. That would have made her die quite early in her life. It was 1552 that she was killed after a wagoning accident, and the church remembers her. She passed away on this day in 1552. When we come back from this break, we're going to be spending the last half hour with Pastor Walt Snyder. Pastor Bill Swirla said that everything he learned, everything he's written recently about the ancient songs of Advent called the O Antiphons, he learned from Pastor Walt Snyder. We'll be talking about those ancient songs, doing a brief run-through of each and every one of them here in the waning days of Advent, before Advent gets away from us. Pastor Walt Snyder on the other side of this break. Feel free to give us a call in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.